You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Earlier today, the director of Idaho's Department of Health and Welfare, Dave Jeppesen, made the decision to activate crisis standards of care for the entire state of Idaho. That means hospitals do not have enough resources to adequately treat patients, whether they are having a heart attack, they're hurt in a car accident, or they have COVID-19. St. Luke's Health System requested the designation because of a massive increase of COVID-19 patients in all areas of the state that have exhausted existing resources. The Crisis Standards of Care Committee met yesterday and agreed that hospitals are simply overwhelmed. Doctors and nurses are exhausted, and they are running out of beds and other resources to treat patients. So today, we are taking a break from our fall fund drive to spend the next 90 minutes talking about what this means and how it will affect all of us. Joining us today are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Stephen Nemerson, our chief clinical officer for St. Alphonsus Health System. Both doctors were on our roundtable yesterday, so I am sorry that at one point we have to have you back, but also appreciate that you are willing to come back today. So thank you both.
Glad to be with you, Gemma.
And Dr. Nemerson, I'd like to start with you and get your thoughts on today's move to activate critical standards of care across our state.
Gemma, it's tragic, and it was completely unnecessary. Had people only gotten their vaccination and kept apart from one another and kept their faces covered, we wouldn't be in this situation. But we've been talking about this for several weeks. We've seen it coming, and it's just part of the continuum of stretching our care resources to be able to make sure that we take care of everyone and that we save the most lives that we possibly can as we go through this continuing surge.
And Dr. Nemerson, what exactly is going on at St. Alphonsus today as these standards of care go into effect?
Well, as I said, this is part of a continuum. So we described our situation yesterday as extreme contingencies, meaning that we were expanding our clinical care teams and we were continuing to be able to take care of patients as they came to us. Things haven't changed. We're continuing to do that exact same work. We're implementing new strategies. And we will continue to be able to serve the patients that are out there, but we're going to be doing it in different ways, and we're not going to be doing it as quickly, and we're making very, very difficult decisions about delaying care for those that truly need us. And that's the big tragedy of this, is patients with cancer, patients in pain, patients with other life-limiting conditions are now being delayed in their ability to get those things tended to. And as was discussed yesterday, the other thing connected with this is we know we are placing patients at jeopardy, that by not getting their conditions tended to, we know in some cases that they will have a worse outcome because of this.
Dr. Pate, your thoughts on activating crisis standards of care across the entire state today?
Well, it's a sad day. And it's a sad day because this was preventable. It's a sad day because we chose to fight with each other rather than come together as Idahoans and a community to support each other, to support our healthcare workers. It's a sad day because our health leaders begged the schools, please require masks. We are dangerously close to crisis standards. Please do this. And then with the exception of Boise School District, which I commend highly, it was tragic. I was in shock to listen to schools decide not to listen to these healthcare leaders that were so passionate. In fact, one of our healthcare leaders, understandably, broke down while he was explaining how difficult this is for our hospitals and our healthcare workers. But people either didn't believe it or just chose to bury their head in their sand. And now here we are. And so I agree complete with Dr. Nemerson. people are going to suffer because of this. And it's not just people with COVID. It's not just a matter of those who did not choose to get vaccinated or did not choose to wear masks that are going to suffer. It's going to be many different people with different conditions that are going to suffer. And it's a very, very sad day. I hope and I pray this is our wake-up call and that we say, okay, enough fighting, enough promoting lies. Let's come together. Let's do what it takes to get past this. It wouldn't take long if we all decided to do it together. But I don't know that we're able to do that.
Dr. Nemerson, you and the president and CEO of St. Alphonsus sent out a memo earlier today to your staff about this move and about how you're working to help your doctors and your nurses and other employees get through this difficult time. You know, we've talked a lot about how this crisis standard of care will impact patients. But how will it impact medical workers? Because doctors and nurses are trained to give everyone the best care they can. And now they're having to potentially make decisions that they never could have expected.
That's right, Gemma. And we did send out a memo earlier today, but it's part of our ongoing communication with our team members to let them know that we're all in this battle together to take care of the most patients that we can and ensure that we maintain a reasonable quality of care for those that need us. In terms of resiliency among our colleagues, one, we're encouraging outreach to one another and being comfortable to speak up and express their individual frustration, their despondency, and to reach out to multitude of services that we have across our health system for them. Included in that is mission leaders and mental health support services that we have. What's occurring is a moral tragedy. It's caregivers who are witness to deaths among patients where those deaths weren't necessary. Frustration at the inability to get to a patient's bedside as quickly as they used to because they have more patients to care for. And the other thing that you need to understand and the public needs to understand is that we have a huge number of staff members who didn't work in our system over the past several years. So they're not familiar with our processes. They don't know where to get equipment and medication quickly. And so that impacts the ability to deliver the quality of care that we are used to delivering. That's only going to get worse. But sadly, it's necessary because we have too many people to take care of that are too sick. You can imagine what that's like as a professional in any kind of business where you want to do the very best you can for the people that you serve. And the ability to do that is slowly being eaten away. And you're being told to do more for more people with less, including your own team members. It's unforgivable, but it's the situation that we find ourselves in right now. And we're going to continue to do this. But until we start to see this surge peak and then decline, it's only going to get worse.
You know, Dr. Pate, you mentioned that you hope that people will come together and take this seriously. We know that there are naysayers out there. Some people believe that the reason why we have to go to crisis standards of care is because certain hospitals mandated vaccines. And so they had a mass exodus of hospital staff. And if hospital staff were just allowed to not be vaccinated, we wouldn't have this problem. Frankly, that's misinformation. Can you clarify that train of thinking?
Oh, yes, because you're quite right. That is just, it's demonstrably false. So let's just look at this. Of all the hospitals in the state of Idaho, only a minority have actually made these vaccine requirements. If you look at the hospitals in northern Idaho, you'll remember back, I think it was about 10 days ago, they went on crisis standards of care. That affected 10 hospitals up there. None of those 10 hospitals had a vaccine requirement. So that clearly was not the explanation. If you look at St. Luke's now, St. Luke's Health System, they actually have more employees today than they did in the summer before the requirement. And in fact, they haven't terminated anybody's employment yet. And I'm under the impression, neither has St. Al's, that they were just now getting to the point of employees that hadn't gotten vaccinated would start going through the process, but nobody's been terminated yet. So St. Luke's has more staff than they've ever had. They have devoted a lot more resources. The problem is not that the vaccine requirement at all. The problem is we have too many people not following public health advice, getting sick, and thinking that either because they're young and healthy, they're going to be perfectly fine. They don't have to worry about COVID. And now they're seeing that's wrong. They may have decided for any of the number of the reasons being promoted that is false information, why they shouldn't get the vaccine. And now finding they're wrong. The very sad thing is that both St. Luke's and St. Al's are treating women who are pregnant who didn't get vaccinated, and now both the mother and baby are at risk. I mean, the problem is not the vaccine requirement. The problem is that we as Idahoans have cared more about our personal liberties than our community responsibilities to bring this disease under control, to protect our hospitals, to protect our healthcare workers, to protect our families and protect our friends and coworkers. That is the problem. If anybody says otherwise, it is demonstrably false.
Thanks, Dr. Pate and Dr. Nemerson here. We need to put this nonsense to rest. The fact is at St. Alphonsus Health System, where we do have this vaccine requirement, we have not yet reached the time in which we are going to be enforcing that requirement. We've been compassionate and given our colleagues plenty of time to get the vaccine, and that time continues. Within the past 3 months, we've increased our staff significantly to take care of our patients and the surge that we're experiencing. And in the past 5 years, we have never had more employees and caregivers in our facilities than we have right now. So we need to dispense with this myth that somehow a vaccine requirement is impacting our ability to deliver care. The other thing connected with that is we know based on the data that we have within our health system that the rate at which employees are contracting COVID is significantly reduced by the fact that they're now vaccinated. And if we did not have the vaccination requirement, we know that the number of employees who would be on quarantine right now would be 3 times the number that actually are on quarantine due to COVID exposure. So the vaccine works, it protects individuals, and it's keeping our staff working to be able to take care of the patients that need us.
Dr. Payne, I also want to talk about the younger population, because it was the there was a doctor, she is the assistant state epidemiologist, and she noted that we are seeing cases, more cases in 13 to 17 year olds. In fact, that's the fastest growing number of cases. Now, that doesn't mean it's the most number, but it's just the fastest growing. The second fastest growing group is in 5 to 12 year olds. And 5 to 11 year olds cannot be vaccinated yet. Are you concerned that this surge that we're seeing is going to, at some point, impact our children? And again, there is misinformation out there that, well, it doesn't affect children as much. And that is true, that it doesn't, but they shouldn't be getting it to begin with.
Right. Well, Jim, you first of all, as usual, you're exactly right. And I have a number of comments to make, but Dr. Nimerson is a pediatric intensivist, a specialist in intensive care. So I want him to feel free to jump in when I'm done or correct anything I say. But here's what I think are the major points. Number one, and I think this is where there was a major failing to understand on the part of school boards and many parents. So number one, this Delta variant that we're dealing with is different in many ways from what we dealt with last year. It is true that last year, very few children got seriously ill. Very few children required hospitalization. Very few children died. It is still true that most children who become infected, even with Delta, are going to do well. But we are seeing far more hospitalizations here in Idaho and around the country for children than we ever saw with the previous variants. And that may just be a reflection of how much more contagious Delta is. I think it's still unclear, is it causing more severe disease? But when it's more contagious and we infect a lot more children, you are going to have some that do poorly and end up in the hospital. And we are seeing that now, including children that have to be put on ventilators. The other thing that we saw in the South, eastern part of the United States earlier in this Delta wave is that as it progressed, that age range went down and it got to progressively lower and lower average ages of children in the hospital. So this is heartbreaking. The key mistake that school boards made is to say that we can have a more contagious variant today and we can take less precautions than we took last year. And what is happening is many, many, many more children are getting infected. And even though they're doing well, they are now transmitting it in the community. Last year, we didn't see very much community spread from schools. This year, we're seeing a lot. And what they do is they infect their households. They infect their parents. And if you look in Idaho at the age groups of what you would anticipate to be parents of school-aged children, less than half of them are fully vaccinated. So what happens is these children get infected, by and large do well, although some are ending up in our hospitals. But what they do is they infect their parents, and their parents are the ones that are now filling our ICU beds. And so this is a real problem. It is a problem of our own making because, number one, as you pointed out, we have for some time been able to get 12 and above children vaccinated. And we pled with people, if you want a normal school year, get those kids vaccinated. And yet, who are we having the fastest growth in? Just as you said, these children that are eligible for vaccination. For the other children that aren't eligible for the vaccination, the best way that we can protect them, number one, everybody who can get vaccinated because you're one less person that's likely to infect that child. Number two, when those children are going to be around people outside their households, for example, schools, have them wear masks and we protect children. So I'll stop with that, but maybe Dr. Nimerson would want to add since he's an expert in this area.
Well, thanks, Dr. Pate. Really, you've described the situation in its entirety. I think there's a couple things that I can add, though, that will help parents in making some decisions. The first is that well, this is frightening. We can't live our lives in fear, and interaction among children is critically important to their development. So it's how do you allow that to take place in a safe way? And we know how to do that. We've been talking about this for a year and a half now. It's distance, masks, and vaccination. So if your kid's over 12, get them vaccinated. It's not too late. It does take time for the doses to kick in, but when we get that first dose in, there's partial protection. When we get the second dose in, there's even more. So get that done. With regard to children who are hospitalized, well, it's rare. And that's one of the things we can be confident in. It's not that rare in children who are immunocompromised. So keep that in mind when trying to protect your child. And then sadly, those that do get hospitalized and end up in an intensive care unit, in many cases, end up just as sick as adults. In fact, in some cases, more sick than adults, particularly with this multi-system inflammatory syndrome that we've seen. It's extraordinarily rare, but it's almost entirely unique to children. And it's the coronavirus plus the effects that come from the coronavirus in the body on the body. Essentially, the entire body starts attacking itself. And, you know, children are our greatest gift. I have my own. I want to keep them protected. And I sure as heck don't want them to be that one in 100,000 child that gets this multi-system inflammatory syndrome. So I'm going to do the very best I can without totally jeopardizing their ability to have anything near a normal life. I'm going to do the very best I can to protect them, and that includes getting them the vaccine, which mine have both received.
I couldn't agree with you more, Dr. Nemerson. I think, you know, having children have some type of normalcy during this is so critically important. So, you know, wear a mask. I mean, my nine-year-old does not care, but it certainly keeps him in school. We will have more of our special coverage on the state switching to crisis standards of care. We do need to take a quick break. More Idaho Matters right now. We are very sad to have to report that as of this morning, the entire state of Idaho is now in crisis standards of care. These guidelines help hospitals decide who should get life-saving care and who should not after COVID-19 patients have overwhelmed our hospitals. We are waiting for a news conference from healthcare leaders across our state who will talk about what's happening in their hospitals and how today's activation will impact anyone who needs care. Now, we will take that news conference live when it starts around 1:30 this afternoon. So Idaho Matters will remain on the air until we go to that news conference. We are so fortunate to have Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, a current member of Idaho's Coronavirus Task Force, join us, along with Dr. Stephen Nemerson, who is with St. Alphonsus. He is the Chief Clinical Officer. Dr. Nemerson, before we start talking about what exactly crisis standards of care are, we left the conversation in the last segment talking about kids and allowing them to have some type of normalcy. And, you know, I have one child who is vaccinated. I have one child that cannot be vaccinated yet. Much to the chagrin of my oldest child, I still make him mask. We never stop masking in our house. And thankfully, my children's school did ultimately require masks. But Dr. Nemerson, can we talk about, you know, what masks actually do? Because once again, there is misinformation around masking.
Excellent question, Gemma. The fact is that my mask protects you and your mask protects me. And with that understanding, when we're in a group setting of kids, they all need to be masked so they can protect each other. And I think that what's going on here is that the parents who are responsible and like you are telling their children to cover their faces, they're not speaking up loudly enough, and they're not demanding that school administrators protect their children by requiring masks in their schools. It's unforgivable. And the other thing that's going on, and I hear these stories every day, is that children who are covering their faces are being bullied by those who aren't. They're being ridiculed. It's unforgivable. And back before COVID, we had all these initiatives in our schools against bullying and in trying to create environments that treated all kids fairly and helped those that were introverted to come out of their shell and help those who were extroverted or bullying to be kind and to realize that that just is unacceptable behavior. We need to get back to that. And we need to encourage those that are covering their faces and doing the right thing to be elevated, and those that are not doing the right thing to be, if not disciplined, at least corrected. And I really look to our teachers and to our school administrators to start thinking about that. And if there isn't a mask mandate in their schools, how to at least create an environment that really encourages that.
Because Dr. Nemerson, I mean, this goes there is a ripple effect, and when we have mask optional in schools, that ultimately impacts the fact that we have now had to implement crisis standards of care.
That's entirely correct, and I want you to think about this too. Among teenagers, how hard is it to be different, to be that kid mm-hmm. that's got a covering on their face? It's impossible. And so what we do in schools transfers into the groups and the social activity that's going on outside of schools. We've got to reverse this trend because we're in this spiral now going downhill, and we're seeing it in our hospitals in terms of patients that are getting sick and overwhelming our services, and some of whom are dying. We got to make that connection, come together as a community. Dr. Pate stated it so eloquently earlier in this discussion. We've got to get together as a community and work together, not this division, not this misinformation. And I just can't say enough about how eloquently Dr. Pate put that.
Dr. Pate, we have been talking a lot about crisis standards of care since it was activated in North Idaho last Monday. But can you talk about how it works, especially since it's now impacting the entire state?
Yeah, so let me just try to, I think a lot of people really don't understand this. So I'm going to try to explain it kind of at a high level. So let's take a normal time. That's not now. Let's take, how did we do this? How did we do things when we were not capacity constrained? Well, what we did is, Gemma, let's take you. If you mm-hmm. came into the emergency room and you had a life-threatening condition, and Dr. Nemerson was seeing you, what his practice would be, determine what is necessary to save Gemma's life, and he would order it, and it would be done. That's normal times. Now, in crisis standards of care, that means that we don't have all the resources to give every patient like Gemma that shows up in our ER all of the care that Dr. Nemerson would normally order. So we might be constrained for beds. We might be constrained for nurses. We might be constrained for ventilators. We might be, you know, last year we had some shortages of medications that are really important to give people when we need to put them on a ventilator. Right now, there's a national shortage of a certain type of breathing machine that we call a BiPAP that we use to try to avoid people having to go on ventilators, but there's a national shortage of those. So if we don't have enough of those, then our only option for some patients is we've got to go ahead and put them on a ventilator. But now then we can face shortages of ventilators. So it can be any number of different things that we might have a restraint on at any one day, at any one time in any one hospital. And it can shift because all through the day, the patients are shifting. Some are getting better and can be moved to lower levels of care. Some are getting worse, unfortunately dying, and that frees up a ventilator or a bed. It changes all the time. But in crisis standards, because we don't have enough to give every patient like you in the emergency room all that care that Dr. Nimerson would normally give, now what he has to do is he has to look at the 5 or 10 patients in that emergency room who all need an ICU bed, all need an ICU nurse, may all need a ventilator, but we don't have that many. And what he has to do is he has to score everybody. Mm. And that scoring system tells us, in essence, which of you are more likely to survive? Because if we've got limited resources, let's at least give them to the people that are most likely to benefit from that. Now, that means some people that in normal times, we would have definitely given them a chance, even if we didn't think they had good chances, we still would have done everything for. We just don't have that luxury now. Now, what it doesn't mean that if we score you, Gemma, and let's say I'm in the next bed and Dr. Nimerson scores me worse than you, what it doesn't mean is that you get the ICU bed and the ventilator and I get nothing, or I get kicked out to the curb, or I'm told to go home. It just means I may be stuck in the emergency room for hours or days. It may mean I can't get the ventilator, but I get maybe that BiPAP I was talking about and other things to try to get me through. I'll still get fluids. I'll still get pain medicines. I'll get those things, but I just may not get it in the ICU setting with a specially trained ICU nurse with a much smaller ratio of nurses to patients. Whereas in the ER, in the hallway, or in the lobby of the hospital, I may have, you know, a nurse that's having to take care of 6 or 10 patients and not just me. So that's kind of the difference. It's not that you don't get you don't get any care, but you won't get all of the care.
Right. And I think that's important for people to know. Let's take another break. Please stay with us for this special coverage on the state switching to crisis standards of care. More Idaho Matters next. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Today, Idaho's Health and Welfare activated a provision that allows hospitals to ration medical care to patients in response to a crush of COVID-19 patients overwhelming their resources. We are waiting for a news conference from healthcare leaders all across Idaho. They will be talking about what's happening in their hospitals and how today's activation will impact anyone who needs care. Now, we will take that news conference live. It starts at 1:30 this afternoon, so Idaho Matters will continue until we take that news conference. Continuing to join us right now are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, as well as Dr. Stephen Nemerson, Chief Clinical Officer for St. Alphonsus Health System. Dr. Pate, you tweeted out this morning, quote, "I can't believe that we didn't come together to prevent this from happening. It appears we have to learn the hard way," unquote. How are you feeling today?
Well, you know, it's a mixture of emotions, Gemma. One is I feel very sad because there are people who have done everything that we've asked who are going to be impacted by what's happening today and through no fault of their own. So on one hand, I'm feeling sad. On the other hand, I'm feeling incredibly frustrated because we seem to have this thought on the part of many that, you know, whatever's happening in other countries, whatever's happening in other parts of the country, somehow that's not going to happen to us because we've had months of warning that this was coming. I remember I was giving warnings back in the summer based on what we were seeing with summer activities of what we should expect with the school year. I mean, this should not have caught us by surprise. And of course, we have heard from medical leaders like Dr. Nimerson, like Dr. Bramwell, like Dr. Nasser, like Dr. Souza, that Dr. Peterman, that just warning us and pleading with us to please take this seriously because it's overwhelming our hospitals. This is going to be a threat to us. And yet, for some reason, we just ignored it. And so it's very frustrating because we've had so many opportunities during the course of this pandemic to bring it under control, if not to have eliminated it. And we just seem to continue to allow these chances to go. And then I will say my other emotion, and it's only happened more recently, is really anger. It's anger at some people who are presenting themselves as knowledgeable and expert, but promoting misinformation and even disinformation that they know better, but it's hurting people. And I'm just at the point I'm angry.
And Dr. Nemerson, I'm curious about how you're feeling, but also how your colleagues are feeling and what they're telling you about what it's like to be inside the ER and the ICU right now.
Well, we're all feeling the same emotions as Dr. Pate. I'd add one, which is I feel immensely proud. I walk through my medical center every day and I'm visiting others throughout our system. And the pride that I have in seeing our teams come together in ways that they've never had to before, the conversations that I've been part of in collaboration across the entire state, it really does warm my heart. And I think it's fantastic. And I think we're going to continue that kind of work together long after the pandemic is gone. If there's one silver lining, that's it. In terms of what my colleagues are experiencing, particularly the leaders of St. Alphonsus Health System, it's the same thing that Dr. Pate has described. And it's also fear, because this isn't getting better. We look at the progression and we see that within the next month, we're going to be at that most extreme of crisis standards of care. I will say that if people hurry up and get vaccinated and start implementing radical separation and face covering, that we could bail out of this and start to see a plateau. I hope that we do see that. But if the most dire predictions become true, then people are going to lose their lives where they don't have to.
Dr. Pate, should the state be doing more right now to help stop the spread of COVID? I mean, especially now that we're rationing resources. I think a lot of people are wondering if the governor needs to step in at this point. I mean, we've never had a mask mandate in our state. We have one of the lowest vaccination rates. At the same time, as I ask you this question, I wonder even if the governor did step in and put mandates in place, if it would actually even make a difference.
Well, Gemma, I think a lot about this topic and have through the pandemic. I think it's even a third outcome other than the two that you mentioned. I think it could actually make things worse. And so, here's how I think about it. Number one, I want to applaud Governor Little. No, he hasn't made every decision that I would have made. No, I don't know that any of us would agree with every decision that he's made. But let me tell you, it has been so refreshing to have a governor, especially when I look at the governors of many other states, a governor who has embraced data, embraced science, listened to experts, which today it seems to be that expertise is disregarded. But he has listened. He has learned. He is incredibly knowledgeable about this. He asks extremely good questions. So I have nothing but the highest praise for Governor Little, because he has not bought into a lot of the nonsense that other governors and leaders in his party have. Now, with that said, you know, are there more things he could do? Of course. And one thing that I've always said as a CEO, a long-term CEO, there's a lot of powers that I had that I shouldn't necessarily use. And you have to be very careful. And here's what I'm talking about. He did an amazingly brave and smart thing back in March of 2020. He did the statewide stay-at-home order. And that was exactly what we needed. And the data shows our case rates came down in 2 weeks, it dramatically, tenfold. And so no question it worked. But what was the price to be paid for that? Our lieutenant governor has gone completely cray-cray. I think that's the word my kids tell me.
It's the word my kids use.
And even yesterday, the second highest leader of this state was holding a conference to promote disinformation while our hospitals were buckling under. That's who's in the wings trying to take advantage of every step that the governor makes so that she can replace him. God help us. And then you look at the legislature that I'll also put in the same category of cray-cray. So what do? People are upset about the, you know, who we designated as essential personnel. They're upset about mask mandates. They're upset about the previous stay-at-home order. So what do? They do an unprecedented power grab, and our legislature tries to take on powers and strip those from the governor, from our public health districts, everything. And now their path, while we can't get the legislature to spend 1 hour talking about what do we do to prepare for the next pandemic, they are passing all these laws to cripple us in handling this pandemic and any future one. And so I think the governor has to weigh, and thank God I'm not the governor. He is an incredibly difficult spot, but he has to weigh. Yes, there are things that he could do, and maybe under normal circumstances he would do. But if he does them, he knows that it's Newton's law. For every action, there's a reaction. And unfortunately, those reactions from our lieutenant governor and our legislature could harm us far worse into the future. So I understand. Personally, there might be some things I would do that he hasn't been willing to do, but I'm not in the same situation he is. And I have tremendous respect for how he's managed this.
Well, Dr. Pate, you are always a straight shooter, which we so appreciate here on Idaho Matters. Dr. Nemerson is needing to leave us. He is very busy today. So a thank you to Dr. Nemerson. Dr. Pate will stay with us. More Idaho Matters next. More Idaho Matters right now. I'm Gemma Gaudette. As of this morning, the entire state of Idaho is now in crisis standards of care. These guidelines help medical professionals and hospitals decide who should get life-saving care and who should not. It is the first time these standards have been enacted statewide, and it comes after unvaccinated COVID-19 patients have filled up our hospitals. Now, what does this mean for the doctors and the nurses who will be making these previously unthinkable and unimaginable decisions? Well, to learn more about this difficult topic, our Morning Edition host, George Prentice, recently spoke with Dr. Matthew Winia. He's the founder of the University of Colorado Center for Bioethics and Humanities. Let's take a listen.
When it comes to pandemic ethics, I have heard you refer to the three R's, restriction, rationing, and responsibility. Could you talk a little bit about the third R, if you will, the responsibility? It seems as if we have shifted so much, if not put all of the responsibility on the shoulders of our caregivers.
Yeah. And, years ago when we were thinking about the responsibilities in the pandemic, we were really thinking mostly about, will doctors and nurses come to work in the event that there is an infectious illness that doesn't have a treatment, that doesn't have a vaccination? And how will we ensure that people will come to work? And as it turns out, when the pandemic came along, doctors did show up, nurses did show up, EMTs did show up for work. And instead, the conversation around the ethics of caring for each other has really devolved much more into the general public and the responsibilities of organizations, of employers, of the government, of, and as you alluded to, of individuals towards each other, towards our neighbors, towards our families. What responsibility do we have now that we have a vaccine, for example, to be vaccinated, even though there are side effects of the vaccine, even though it might cause you to take a day off of work, that kind of thing? Is that, and you may feel you're a very low risk person, but do you have a responsibility to the rest of the community to reduce the spread of the disease among the low risk population? It's been a very interesting evolution of that aspect of ethical issues in pandemics.
We keep hearing the word triage. So I'm trying to imagine this in my mind's eye. When triage is performed, is it fair for a doctor? Well, I guess fairness goes out the window, but we are talking about a doctor having to decide yes or no to someone. But what if there's similar care available somewhere else?
Yeah, one of the main points of having crisis standards of care, of having triage protocols ready in advance, is that it hopefully allows you to avoid having to make the most difficult decisions. Because, for example, one of the things we insist on in our triage protocols is that the individual doctor at the bedside should not be the one making that decision, because that doctor may not know that there's a bed available in a hospital six doors away. So there really needs to be a committee that has good, what they call situational awareness of where the beds are across the city or across the whole state, who can then make decisions about allocating those scarce resources to do the most good.
I've heard a lot of lay people, such as myself, keep saying, well, it's all about saving the most lives. Is that accurate?
Well, that is the first order criterion that we tend to use. You don't want to use, you know, precious limited resources on someone who is not going to make it anyways. And you also don't want to spend precious resources on someone who is going to survive even without getting those resources. So it's really this balancing act of trying to find the optimal use of resources to give to those people who will survive if they get them, and will not survive if they don't. And that is the first order criterion. That said, there are other things that also come into play. Issues of equity come into play, and, you know, other ways of sort of looking at fairness across the allocation system.
But then we open up the conversation of a 12-year-old versus an 80-year-old, quantity versus quality.
And that's within the framework of saving the most lives. So you're still in the first order framework here of let's try to save the most lives. Then someone's going to ask, well, does a life that has 30 years to live count the same as a life that has 2 years to live? And that need not be correlated with age, right? If someone has end-stage pancreatic cancer, they may have only a year or so to live. Would you give the same resources to that person as you would to someone else who may be 80 years old, but doesn't have that kind of an end-stage illness?
Let's talk about guilt and anger. It seems forever ago, but it was only 6 months ago, that there was vaccination guilt of those that were getting the vaccine, feeling guilty about those who hadn't gotten theirs yet. And now we're at a stage of anger of people who are vaccinated, and they're getting angry at those who choose not to be.
Yeah, and I think you will see that in double or triple form if you talk to anyone in the healthcare system who, you know, sees the current wave of infections and death as being avoidable. And so there's an enormous amount of anger. There's even anger across states. You know, if you go to the ICUs in Colorado right now, my colleagues in the ICU are fielding 30, 40 calls a day from out-of-state hospitals seeking to transfer patients to us. And I have to say, there are people in our ICUs that are starting to say, really, you know, we're pretty full right now. Is it our responsibility to bail out the states that are not doing what they need to do to keep community transmission rates low?
Is it your sense that mandates or requirements, whatever word people choose, is it your sense that they can sometimes backfire?
Oh, absolutely. There are ways in which any kind of, you know, a legislated type requirement can cause people to become entrenched and defensive rather than, okay, I'll go ahead and do it. The question is not so much, can they ever backfire for any given individual? It's, do they tend to backfire on balance, or do they tend to get us closer to the goal? And on balance, they do tend to get us closer to the goal. We have a lot of experience over many, many years, not just this pandemic, of what it takes to bring a global epidemic to a close. We've done it with measles. We've done it with rubella. We've done it with, you know, chickenpox. We've done it with many, many illnesses. And what it takes in the end is typically a good vaccine and the requirement that people use that vaccine, because there are folks who won't want to get any vaccine. You know, every time we've had a vaccination program, there's a small cadre of people who will refuse to get it. This one's been a larger cadre of people for understandable reasons. This vaccine was developed very rapidly, so people have more questions about it. That's legitimate. Although at this point, we now have, you know, more experience clinically with this vaccine in terms of the numbers of people who've received it and how closely they've been followed over the last year. We have much, much more information on this vaccine than we've had on any prior vaccine that is in widespread use.
Pre-pandemic, so many competing health systems, I know here in Idaho, they were, well, quite simply, they were competing. But I have to say that I am impressed by how doctors and especially administrators have been talking to each other and sharing with one another, unlike any time we've ever seen before.
Yeah, we saw the same thing in Colorado. I don't know that every state has seen this, but there are a number of excellent examples around the country of health systems, which are normally in competitive posture towards each other, being willing to share resources, to share information, to transfer patients back and forth, and even to transfer equipment and personnel back and forth if needed, in order to keep the community as safe as possible. I would love to see some of that communal spirit survive the pandemic and go on and become the new normal for us. It would certainly be a better normal than where we're coming from. I think if we want that to happen, we're going to have to be very proactive about maintaining it. It will not just maintain itself. The basic underlying structure of a competitive marketplace is not something that will just change on its own because people are feeling good about each other right now.
That was Dr. Matthew Winia, the founder of the University of Colorado's Center for Bioethics and Humanities, speaking with our George Prentice. We're going to take a quick break and come back for more of this special edition of Idaho Matters. But before we do, I want to thank everyone who has taken some time out of their incredibly busy schedules to come on the program today and talk about Idaho switching to crisis standards of care. We know just how busy all of you are right now. So a thank you to Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Pate will be rejoining us here in a moment, but a thank you to Dr. Stephen Nemerson, Chief Clinical Officer for St. Alphonsus Health System. He had to get off the call and get back to work, as well as everyone who is working behind the scenes on our program today. We'll be right back. For those of you just joining us this morning, Idaho Health and Welfare's director activated crisis standards of care for the entire state of Idaho. This is due to the overwhelming number of COVID-19 swamping hospitals around the Gem State. Director Dave Jeppesen said this morning that the situation is dire and that we don't have enough resources to adequately treat patients in our hospitals. So that means all hospitals in our state are now able to ration medical care, including ventilators, ICU beds, and staff time. So right now, we are waiting for a news conference from healthcare leaders all across Idaho, who will be talking about what's happening in their hospitals and how today's activation will impact anyone who needs care. We will take that news conference live as soon as it begins in about 30 minutes, so that is why Idaho Matters is remaining on the air until then. So right now, I want to turn back to Dr. David Pate. As many of our listeners know, he is the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, as well as a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Pate, you came on Idaho Matters at the start of the COVID-19 outbreak last year, and we have been doing our Wednesday Daughter Roundtable for more than a year and a half now. Did you ever think that we would still be talking about COVID-19 at this point, but at the level that we are right now?
Oh, heck no. I'm just shocked that we're in the position we are when you consider this is 2021 and how much more we know about viruses and epidemiology than, say, 100 years ago when we had the Spanish flu. Here we know all this. We had unprecedented, amazing vaccines. I mean, I remember being on your show a year ago and saying I was hoping that the vaccines might be 60 or 70% effective. I never dreamed they would be this effective and that we'd have multiple. I mean, it's just amazing that we've done this and yet we have still squandered our opportunity to control this disease. I had no idea we would be here.
And I have to say, Dr. Pate, in all transparency, back in June, we were having team meetings on Idaho Matters saying, we've got the vaccine, things are going well. Do we really need to be doing this roundtable every week? And we made the decision to scale it back a little bit. You'd come on each week, just you, for like one segment, maybe two. I think that lasted about 3 weeks because all of a sudden it started ramping up again. And, I think, and that's just to put it into perspective for people as to where I think we all believed we were with this pandemic. And I set that up to ask that, do you think some of this and where we're at now, it is just pure fatigue on people's part, right? I mean, we are all so tired. Yet I say that in the utmost respect for healthcare workers who, if I say I'm tired, I cannot even imagine how tired and exhausted they are.
Yeah, it's certainly the case that our healthcare professionals, our public health officials, who they don't get nearly enough credit in all this, there's no question they're exhausted physically and emotionally. What I think is a sad reflection is that so many in our American public are exhausted when all we've asked is, could you wear a mask? Could you avoid really large gatherings? And could you get the vaccine? We didn't say, could you donate a kidney? We didn't say, could you give us all your retirement savings? We didn't say, can you lock yourself up in your house for the rest of your lives or wear masks for the rest of your lives? We just said, could you just help us control the spread of this disease? And the sacrifice that we've asked of the public, avoiding these large gatherings, wearing masks, getting vaccinated, pale in comparison to the sacrifices that our public health and our medical workers are making.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pate, I reflected this weekend because it was, as all of us know, the 20th anniversary of September 11th. And I vividly remember how we all came together as Americans when that happened, right? It all of a sudden didn't matter what your political affiliations were. It didn't matter about all of those other things that we may disagree on. There was such a sense of unity in our country because we had been attacked. And yet at the same, and now here we are 20 years later and we're under attack again. It's just a different enemy. And it is hard when you reflect on where we were 20 years ago, even for a short amount of time, right? I mean, it was probably about a year or so, right? That we had that sense of unity. And it seems that it has completely gone away.
Yeah. It's really startling. And because I certainly expected that, just like always, when we face a common threat, we all come together. And I thought President George W. Bush's comments, I've lost track of time. I don't remember how many days ago he made them, but I just thought they captured it so quickly or so well when he was mentioning, you know, these things about that's not who America is. And that's not the America that he knows. And I agree. It's not the America that I know.
Do you ever get just so frustrated with all of this? I would assume the answer is yes.
Oh yeah, there's times where I get so frustrated that, you know, I need to take a break. You know, I did last week. I just told my wife has had cabin fever because we stay relatively secluded and don't take a lot of chances, even though we're both vaccinated. But I told her, let's just go up in the mountains. Let's just get away.
Yeah.
Get away from people, get away from, you know, the social media, the phones, everything. And we did that. And I'll tell you what, it was amazing. It was just just the refresh that I needed. But now I'm going to need one again in probably a week.
I tell you, I'm right there with you, Dr. Pate, honestly. As always, Dr. Pate, thank you so much for your time. And not just today, but literally for the last year and a half. Thank you for continuing to be a straight shooter, for telling us the facts, for your guidance, for your wisdom. Appreciate you so very much.
Oh, thank you, Jim. I appreciate the work that you and Boise State Public Radio are doing.
We are, of course, saying goodbye today to Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Of course, Dr. Pate will join us again next week for our Doctor Roundtable. If you have those questions, get them in, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. We're going to take a quick break, but we will come back with more of this special edition of Idaho Matters. You're listening to a special edition of Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. We're waiting for a news conference from healthcare leaders across Idaho. They'll be talking about what's happening in their hospitals and how today's activation of crisis standards of care will frankly be impacting all of us. We will take that news conference live. It starts around 1:30 this afternoon. So right now joining us is Rachel Cohen. She is our reporter in the Magic Valley. Rachel has been covering the COVID-19 pandemic and the possibility of switching to crisis standards of care. Good to have you on the program, Rachel.
Hi, Gemma. Thanks for having me.
So you did a story recently about how medical workers are exhausted and overwhelmed from all of the COVID-19 patients needing care. Rachel, what have you been hearing from hospitals and medical workers around the state?
Yeah, Gemma, you know, I think this is something that healthcare leaders never wanted to see happen. But unfortunately, in the past few weeks, I think, you know, we've heard several people predict that we would get to this point and that there really wasn't an end in sight. And so I think, you know, healthcare workers were hoping that we could turn this around, but they also are dealing with the reality on a day-to-day basis of seeing more and more patients come in. And so they knew that this was a real possibility.
You heard from Dr. Charles Bertrus today, and he's an emergency department physician at St. Luke's Magic Valley in Twin Falls, and he's also the medical director of Magic Valley Paramedics. Can you talk a little bit about your conversation, Rachel?
Yes, I talked with him yesterday, so actually before crisis standards of care was extended statewide, including to the Magic Valley. But I did ask him, knowing that we could reach this point very soon, how he would describe what it means to people who are trying to get care in his emergency department. And we have a clip right here for you of what he said.
Literally, we don't have anywhere to put you. You know, I don't have a nurse to care for you. I don't have the equipment that you'll need. You know, so if you're not in that final stage, I might not be able to help you.
And you know, right there, he's just trying to explain to people who, you know, maybe haven't been paying as close attention about why this might matter to them, mm-hmm. that they might not be able to get the care that they expect if they show up. And yet I heard him and other doctors say, you know, if you are dealing with a medical emergency, you should seek care immediately.
Well, and Rachel, I would think that that also weighs heavily on their minds, right? That here we activate these crisis standards of care, and then doctors know that some people who, let's say, have a heart attack may not get to the hospital quickly because they don't want to overwhelm the hospital. So then I would think that adds an extra layer of worry. Did you talk about anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, one layer of worry that Dr. Burtis talked about was just the fact that on his previous few shifts in the ER, he works overnights. The hospital did not have an available ICU bed. And so he's working in the ER, you know, treating people that are coming in for emergencies. And he has that knowledge in the back of his head that, you know, if people need a higher level of care, we might not be able to give it to them right here at this facility. And that, he said, you know, makes him very anxious during his shifts.
What else did Dr. Bertris have to say during your conversation today?
So one other thing I asked him was just how he thinks about the disconnect between what's happening inside the hospitals and outside. You know, I asked him if he thought people in the Magic Valley were, you know, taking what's happening seriously or maybe understanding the extent of the crisis that the hospital is in. He said, no, he doesn't think so. He didn't think that people really understood the extent of what was happening. And he had some, you know, blunt words about wanting people to kind of forget their previous attitudes and get the vaccine.
And with that, Rachel, that in the midst of feeling that frustration, you know, they still show up every day and they still give not just the best care they can, but the compassion and the empathy that they show. I mean, you know, what did he say about that? I mean, I would feel like it's almost like you're going into battle every single day.
Yeah. So Dr. Burtis, you know, he has an important role at this hospital. He has a lot of people that, you know, work under him as paramedics, EMTs, ER nurses. And so I think because he's kind of leading this group, he has a perspective of kind of putting one foot in front of another. And knowing that, you know, he said, essentially, if we see more people than what we're seeing now, he doesn't know what's going to come next. And on one hand, he has that perspective. On the other hand, he's trying to keep things together for his team. And so he says, mm-hmm. You know, I'm just going to do, you know, take it one patient at a time, essentially.
And I think we have another piece of audio that we wanted to play from your conversation with Dr. Burtis.
That's the only thing you can do to help us right now is kind of maybe swallow your pride and get a vaccine.
And
one thing he said,
go ahead, Rachel.
So he said, another thing he said about just opinions in the Magic Valley is that he said, we're kind of a freedom loving people. And I think that probably extends to other places in Idaho too. You know, we hear lots of talk about personal freedom. And he said, this is kind of the perfect thing to mess with this particular community because there's just been so much resistance to getting the vaccine. And so those attitudes have really proven to be a weakness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's got to be so frustrating, I would think, Rachel, that, I mean, what we hear in the Treasure Valley from doctors and nurses is that, you know, they're inside the hospitals and they are on the front lines. They are like in a battle. Yet the moment they step out of the hospital, it's like the general public has no idea that not just that there's a pandemic going on, but that we're in a worse place than we were a year ago. And, you know, very few people are wearing masks. We're seeing large events take place, large gatherings. That has to also wear, I would think, on their mental health.
Right. And this is something that we've talked about throughout the pandemic, from nurses and doctors showing up at public meetings, advocating for mitigation strategies like mask mandates, and then having people speak right after them saying that the hospitals are not telling the truth about how many patients are inside their facilities. You know, that disconnect has been present all along during the pandemic, and it has not gone away, despite the new level of crisis that we're in. For example, a school district in Gooding decided this week that they were actually going to require masks for their students because so many staff had tested positive. And there was a protest this morning. I can't tell you how many people showed up to that, you know, because they didn't want their kids to wear masks in schools. And of course, that was happening at the same time that crisis standards of care was declared statewide.
Right. And Rachel, in fact, about a week ago, you had a heart-wrenching story, really an audio diary from an ICU nurse. Just in the few minutes we have left, can you talk a little bit about her?
Yeah, Gemma. So I talked with an ICU nurse in St. Luke's Meridian named Ashley Brown. And it's honestly people like her that I'm really thinking about today. She just did such a great job sharing the varying emotions that frontline healthcare workers like herself are going through right now. You know, sadness, fear, anxiety, and anger. And so, yeah, she just shared her thoughts for us after her shifts in the ICU. And she had a lot to say about what she was seeing there.
Well, Rachel, I know that you need to get off this call with us because you are going to be listening into that news conference coming up. But Rachel, I thank you for all the reporting you've been doing. I know it is not easy. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to our own Rachel Cohen. She is our reporter in the Magic Valley. Rachel's been covering the COVID-19 pandemic and the possibility of switching to crisis standards of care for quite some time. So, of course, you can hear Rachel's other stories at BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.